The message that comes through loud and clear in this episode of Culturally Us is really quite simple. Be who you are. Nick Sharma, a recipe creator, food columnist, and author, whose first book, Season, launched on October 2nd, joined me a few weeks ago to discuss the fascinating story of his life, from his childhood in Bombay, through his early adulthood as a PhD student and scientist, and now finally as a chef, author, award-winning blogger, and photographer. Nick shares how he refused to let tradition stifle his expression of his true self, ultimately following his heart to come out publicly, marry his partner, move to San Francisco, and begin his culinary career. Today, Nick creates unique recipes that blend cultural influences and inspirations, photographs them in a style that is so classically his, and writes about how these recipes are often a metaphor for his experience of the world. His wildly successful blog, A Brown Table, his San Francisco Chronicle weekly column, A Brown Kitchen, and now his debut book, Season, all share Nick's life story as an Indian scientist turned chef who uses food to share his immigrant story by way of personal experiences and regional cuisine. I cannot wait for you to take a listen and be inspired by Nick's story.
Welcome to Culturally Ours, a show where we explore global cultural diversity in an intimate way through conversations and narratives around lifestyle, culture, food, art, and travel. Host Karthika Gupta talks to people from all over the world who have intimately experienced different cultures as a way to understand each other's worlds from the inside out, focusing on what we have in common.
Nick, it's such a thrill to be chatting with you today. Thank you so much for being a part of this show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like everybody knows you already. You're such a celebrity in the culinary space, in the blog space, in the photography space. But maybe for just those of us who don't know you, could you perhaps give a little sneak peek into your world?
Sure. My name is Nick Sharma. I grew up in Bombay, and I still say Bombay. I don't say Mumbai because that's what it was called when I left. I moved to America more than 12 to 15 years ago, and I have been living in California for the past 4 years. I live in Oakland, which is right next to San Francisco. I write a blog called A Brown Table, and I also write a column called A Brown Kitchen for the San Francisco Chronicle, which is, again, a recipe-based column.
Yep. And I'm right there with you. I will never say Mumbai. I'm from Bombay. It just sounds really weird. I think Bombay sounds quite classy, actually, if you ask me. But I'm right there with you. And I know we are going to talk a little bit about your journey and your blog and even the column. But, you know, in some of your past interviews, you've mentioned that all you ever wanted to do was to bake a cake every day. What inspired this love for cooking?
Let's see. Necessity, I think, is probably the mother driver of every action in my life. both my parents worked full-time. And so I would go to school during the week. Thursdays was my day off from school. And when my mother went back to work after she felt like my sister was of the age that she could be left alone with me or with my grandparents, that's when I started to cook because no one was there. You could do what you want. And I would go through her recipes that she had saved in her binders and her old cookbooks. And I would go through that. And then I started to cook from there. And so that kind of was, like I said, necessity, because I could do things the way I wanted to do and not have to eat what they forced down on me.
No, that's awesome. I have a slightly similar story. Both my parents worked too, except that I think I've never quite been as interested in the kitchen.
Okay.
I just thought that, okay, you know, mom, dad, not home. All right, let's gorge on all the chocolate,
yeah,
all the candy that we can get. But that's awesome. Now, you grew up in a sort of a bicultural household, right?
I did, yes, yeah.
So who decided what was for dinner every night, and how did that sort of shape your approach to food?
I think, I mean, you know how it is in India. Things are very different. And of course, it's changed now. Mm-hmm. But as far as I can remember back then, the way things were that either parent would probably go out on the street and you would have, there are no super, at least back then, there were no supermarkets. So you would go to the guy who has his like cart, like his wooden cart that's rolled on large wheels, and you've got vegetables laid out there. So that's where you would buy your vegetables. So whatever was available in that season, you would buy that. And fortunately, living in Bombay, you pretty much get everything year round, except for a couple of seasonal things. But the weather is good for, you know, you could get tomatoes year round. It's not like even in California, they die out when it gets cool, but it doesn't happen there. So the concept of seasonality really never, except for mangoes, I don't think and guavas, the concept of seasonality really didn't come into play until I moved here. And then like the meat and stuff, either my dad or my mom would go, we lived in Bandra, and so they would go and buy meat, or they would send me. So that's pretty much who governed the ingredients. And then they would cook what they bought. And then my parents also had a cook that would come to help out since both of them worked. And she would cook food also.
But I love that approach, though. I mean, the whole seasonality. And so you sort of have this ever-evolving palette of food and fruits and, you know, just like dishes, right? So it's not like because you have tomatoes the whole year round, you're always having tomatoes.
Right.
You know, so it just makes it kind of, I think, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you love to bake.
I do,
but you went to school to be a scientist. What influenced that decision?
Stability. I did want to go to culinary school. So when I was in school, there were two things that I found really interesting. One was chemistry. And the second thing was cooking. Cooking obviously wasn't a part of my curriculum. But there were so many similarities between the two that they both felt like you were doing experiments all the time. So I really enjoyed that. And when I wanted to go to culinary school, so my mom actually works in hospitality management. And so she's worked for a bunch of large hotel chains in Bombay. And she said, I know what goes on behind the scenes, and I don't think that life is for you. It's not easy. And you know, coming from an Indian family, there is a hierarchy of careers. So it's medicine, engineering of some sort, and then let's see, medicine, engineering, and there's one more that I can't think of. But at least in my family, it was medicine, engineering, and business. Maybe business.
Right. I was going to say commerce, but you're right.
Commerce. And so I had cousins who were in medicine. A lot of them were physicians. And so I kind of felt that I would go down that route in some aspect. And I ended up doing biomedical research.
Okay.
And that was kind of fun because I was still, like, a large part of my curriculum was also focused around food, surprisingly, not intentionally. But there were courses that we took on. So I took microbiology. And in microbiology, we studied fermentation. And we got to do our own fermentation, so like making idli, dosa batter, and looking at the batter under microscope to look for the different yeast and bacteria that were in there. We would get, you know, sugarcane juice from the road and then put that in these columns and let them ferment over time to see how bacteria produce pigmentation.
Wow.
So there were all these things that were constantly happening, which was so exciting. At the same time, then when I took biochemistry, that became even more fun because here you would take, I learned how to isolate pectin from apples, oranges, how to isolate, you know, carotenoid pigments from the orange, what is it called? The skin outside.
Peel.
Yeah.
The peel. Yeah.
And so there were all these like fun things happening, how to make gelatin from bones. And so those are the things that I didn't think of then, but that was actually a lot of fun. Like I was going to food and pulling out these things that were there.
Right.
And then there were the things that were visible. And I think for someone like me, anything that's visual is the most exciting. So there were things like chromatography, where I was looking at pigments, isolating pigments from plants like spinach. And it was just amazing to see, like, even something like spinach, when it there's different types of chlorophyll pigments, and they separate differently, and their colors are actually different when they separate. So those were the things that I was really excited by. And then when I moved to, so I was cooking still at this point back in India. And then when I moved to America, I was on my own living by myself. And so I was cooking also for myself. And,
right.
you know, that's when I started exploring the kitchen because I was independent and free. Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is, it's so fascinating. And now my daughter actually loves to cook and I have no idea where she gets this from because I don't. But I have to tell her this because it's so interesting that, you know, science can teach you so much
about
food. That's fascinating. Now, and you came here as a student mm-hmm. and you said you cooked here, and even though I think you came in for like PhD in genetics, right? And you
I said did.
Like your food was like your window to the world. I mean, first of all, how the heck did you find time to cook? I mean, I came here for grad school too, and I think all I survived on was like bananas and 7-layered burritos. I remember that distinctly because there was nothing else there for me to eat, and I did not know my way into the kitchen. But how did you manage to kind of juggle all these sort of different balls and wear all these different hats?
I think probably because I'm high energy most of the time, that probably has something to do with it. But so in grad school, what kind of happened was, like you said, you're always, especially when I was doing my research internships, I was always stuck in a lab. But often the experiments were so long. So you'd wait for these long periods. And I lived on campus for the first year. So I could just walk home and come back late at night and, you know, get my data and finish things off.
Right.
But what happened was I didn't grow up in a rich family. So I had never traveled abroad until that point, till I came to America. And then when I came to America, again, I was kind of stifled by my budget. I wasn't dependent on my parents, but I still had to pay my rent and do other things. And it's not a lot of money. I was lucky I lived in Cincinnati, where the cost of living was low. I don't know what it is now. So I had like some amount of disposable income to spend on food. And I felt that if you're living in another, first of all, I wasn't restricted by any dietary things. So I eat beef and everything. So I didn't have, you know, those things. Not that those are limiting factors, but it does open up a lot of new things for you.
Absolutely.
And so when I came to America, one of the things that I really wanted to experience where I was for what it was. And so I was living, well, I actually lived alone. So I never lived with anyone. And that was a conscious choice. And then the friends that I had were also, I didn't have a lot of Indian friends in grad school because I knew I was gay and I was going to come out. And I was always uncomfortable because of how it was perceived in India. So I didn't feel comfortable at that point to have, you know, to confide in anyone who was from India about that. It just, right. Yeah. So as a consequence, my friends were all American of like people from different countries. Mm-hmm. And also my program was such that I didn't have a lot of people in my class who were from India. Mm-hmm. And so then what happened was, and this was all unintentional, but it just happened that way. So I was forced to go out and eat with my friends who were already used to trying different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I had a friend in grad school who was Italian, and I would go out with her to eat Italian food or Greek food. And then I had another friend who was from New Orleans who, you know, exposed me to Cajun food. So right. There were all these different things. And so for me, since I knew I couldn't afford to travel, this was a way for me to experience the world through food.
Right. That's amazing. I mean, that's what a fantastic way to sort of get ingrained into different cultures, right? I mean, as a... You know, for you as somebody who cooks and, you know, food is such a big part of who you are, it totally makes sense. But even for others, right, who are maybe not like food bloggers or you know, great cooks, just trying new foods from different countries just gives such an insight into the culture, you know, how people eat, the spices, the way they mm-hmm. cook. It's fascinating. So, yeah, what an incredible experience. Now, I have to ask, because I think a lot of Indians come, I certainly came this way. I had two suitcases, and I think my mom kind of gave me one of her pressure cookers, and she was like, here, take this. Use it to cook rice and dal and everything else that you want to eat. Did you do the same thing? Did you come with a pressure cooker, or were you like,
yeah, kind of... I did. And I got rid of it in the first week. So I remember, so when I came to grad school, before I took my flight, there's an Indian Students Association. Yeah. And I think, I don't know if they still have those, but they sent a PDF to all the Indian students. And so my parents happened to see that. And they said, okay, so we need to get you all of these things. And I said, come on, like, first of all, I also, at that point, I had a fear of pressure cookers because my mom had blown the lid off a couple of times and taken the ceiling out. So I don't like stovetop pressure cookers. I use an electric one now. Right. But they insisted that I should take one. And I had heard that, first of all, I don't eat like dal every day, right? And it's like... maybe once a month I'll cook dal. It's not something that's always on because I'm eating other things too. Right. And so I kept telling them that, like, if I'm going to go to another country, I'm not going to want to eat Indian food all day long. Because you want to experience a country for all it has to offer, right? And if I had to do that, then I might as well have just stayed in India.
And I think, that's right.
Right. So, and then they said, well, no, the meat, you know, like for meat. And I mean, I get how fast things cook. But you don't always want the same texture because the other thing. And so I feel like in Indian cooking, sometimes meat is overcooked. And so in the West, it's not always done like that. Often like a steak is cooked to medium rare.
Right, right.
It's very rare that you'll actually cook something till it breaks down, like in pulled pork, for example. Right. And in Indian cooking, we usually go beyond the point of cooking because our meat is also different, right? Our meat is not tenderized before. Meat is usually sold tenderized here. And they anyway didn't listen. So they packed the thing up in my bag and I brought it. And then I gave it to someone who really loved to cook. I met an Indian kid in when I was in Ohio. And I said, hey, so you really like to cook dal every day? You can have my pressure cooker. It's brand new. I've not used it. You can take it. So I got rid of that.
That is so funny. So for me, it was kind of the flip, right? Because I didn't know how to cook.
Okay.
And I am a vegetarian. So, you know, dal and rice. And I'm actually from the South. So a lot of South Indian food is done in the pressure cooker.
Right.
But I never knew how to use it. And it's funny you say your mom blew the top of the cooker because my mom did the same thing. she ruined so many pressure cookers because she didn't know how to use it. But still, she thought maybe I would, you know, kind of know how to use it. She sends me here with one and I'm looking at it going, I have no idea. I have no idea how to use this thing. I've never stepped foot in the kitchen. I don't know what mom and dad were thinking.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? If it makes you feel better, all right, I'll just keep it.
Right.
So yeah, a lot of fun stories around the pressure cooker for sure.
Yeah.
So what happened after after school?
So I... passed my qualifying exam for my PhD, and I still had 2 years left, but I just wasn't happy where I was, and I wanted to get out of it, and I needed a change, because I'd also come out, and I had all this baggage with me, emotional baggage, so I kind of wanted a change. So I said, you know what, I'd also switched labs, and the professor that I was with had also quit and left, so I did switch labs, and I wasn't happy with the way the research was going, and then funding was also all messed up with the government moving research funding to defense. And so I said, this is just kind of depressing watching my professors who are so highly educated trying to beg for funding. And so I said, maybe I need a change. So how about you take a break, go like do some research somewhere. Then if you really want to do it, you know, stick and go and reapply for a PhD. So I went to Georgetown in DC and I worked at the college, at the Department of Medicine, and I did physiological research over there for a while. And then in DC, I thought, you know, I was interacting with a lot of people who were in politics or in the policy field, and I suddenly felt, you know, that would be a nice transition because I did love the policy and the human behavior and the economic aspect of trying to understand how science and health work. And I said, why not go to public policy school at Georgetown? So, and I was throwing myself completely into academia again. So it was work at the hospital during the day and then in the evening go to school.
Right.
And it was fun because I was doing something completely different and it was actually exciting. But at that point, I was still just in academia all the time. And that's when the blog began because someone told me, hey, you know, there's something called a blog. Why don't you do it? You like to cook. And by this point, I was also entertaining a lot more people than I had in grad school. So I'd become much more confident in my skills. And so that's how the blog transpired.
And now the blog is a brown table.
Correct.
So can you tell me a little bit about what inspired that name and what is the kind of message that you're sharing with the blog?
Sure. So the blog's name, A Brown Table, is two things. One is that it is metaphorical, where I'm basically referring to me being brown. And the second thing was there was actually two brown planks that I would shoot on.
Okay.
And I would put one, I would rest them on the recycle and the regular trash can and photograph.
Okay.
And that's how the name transpired for the blog. And so what I wanted to do with the blog, I had noticed that when I moved to America, every restaurant that served Indian food was Indian food that I really didn't eat at home. And so for me, that was really surprising. Like, I could eat South Indian food in restaurants.
Right.
And dosas were really popular. And they still are. And then the Punjabi side of things, the North Indian. And those were like the two predominant versions of India that was being marketed to people. And so one of the things, even in grad school, when I would cook something different, because I was familiar with those recipes, people would say, is that really Indian? And I would say, yeah, it is. And so I realized that there was this part of regional cuisine that was not being spoken about. And so I figured that maybe I should talk about that a little bit because no one knew anything. And I would get all like these questions and I realized that people really don't know or have not been exposed. And the second thing I wanted to do was I noticed also over time that my style of cooking had changed. I was cooking with things that were, one, available in front of me and making, you know, kind of learning how to deal with that and make it what I wanted.
Right.
And I realized I didn't have to fit any mold.
Right.
And so I said, if I'm going to do things, a blog, why also rehash stuff that's already out there?
Right.
Let me do something that I'm really passionate about and I enjoy. And so I went with that attitude, whether people like it. I mean, if they like it, that's always amazing. If they don't like it, well, they can always go somewhere else and find what they want.
Well, you have an amazing following, and I know people love your work.
Oh, thank you.
I would say that, you know, you being different and you sort of almost thinking outside the box and wanting to, you know, do things your own way has really paid off. And also, it's so inspiring also because, you know, like you said, idlis and dosas and North Indian cuisine is all done to, I wouldn't say done to death, but everybody does.
Right.
You know, why not show something a little different, something that you are close to, but still different so that, you know, you can inspire people to think outside the box. So that's amazing. Okay, so now let's kind of follow along your journey.
Mm-hmm.
You've fallen in love at this point and you've gotten married.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So has marriage changed the way you look, you cook now?
The way I look, it's me. I feel like sometimes I've aged.
I know. I said that. I was like, oh, marriage changes everybody.
I feel marriage ages you a little bit.
Totally. And kids even more, perhaps.
That knock on wood hasn't happened yet. But to cook, it has changed because I have to. I remember when I lived alone, I could just call it today and eat whatever I wanted to. Now, like when my husband travels a lot, and so when he's home, then I need to kind of, you know, play around his needs when it comes to eating, because I could easily just toss a salad together and call it a day.
Right.
But he like prefers something a little more substantial. So then I have to like plan ahead and think about that. So I try to do my best. But it is different. I mean, you have to think about someone else all the time.
Correct. Very true. Now, while we were chatting, you mentioned it a couple of times, so maybe I can go to that. You said you know, when you were in school, you came out,
uh-huh.
You've married, and So how did your family sort of react to all these changes in your life?
Well, so I know, like, I had a fortunate experience that my family was open-minded. There were some obstacles initially, like for the first few months where, you know, my mother was having a hard time because she comes from a Catholic family and they are, you know, and so that she was really afraid as to how her family would react. It all worked out really well in the end. But she had a lot of emotional baggage and then I had to deal with that.
Right.
But it wasn't about her. That was the main thing for her to understand. And then, I think they had a harder time with me career changing more than anything.
I was just going to say, yeah.
That was like, I think like a big, like stressful thing, even for my dad. He's like, are you sure? Like you want to do all this like nonsense and blah, blah, blah. And, you don't know anything about all this and you're going to jump and be careful. And, you know, like all those like, and constantly, and you don't like when you're going and taking something risky, you don't need, I mean, those thoughts are already in your head. You don't need someone amplifying them constantly. And so when I took the jump, that was probably the scariest time for them. And eventually, like once they saw it, like, you know, people, you know, like the public being appreciative about it, I think that's when they kind of relaxed. And now they're cool. Like now they behave like as if like all that never happened. But
right. I remember when, because I have a technical background, so I have a double master's in computer science. And up until, 2014, I was actually working in corporate.
Okay.
And I really did love my job. But something in me was sort of, you know, I want to get creative. I always thought I'd never had that creative gene. And when I finally picked up a camera and I started sort of working with a camera and taking photographs, I was like, hey, this is pretty interesting. This is cool. And I think I'm good at it because people are paying me to kind of, you know, take their photographs.
Yeah.
And I remember telling my mom, I was like, okay, don't freak out, but I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to do this full time. And so there was this long pause and I was like, okay, are you still there? And she's like, yeah, I'm here. Okay, but you know, you can always just try it for a year and then, you know, get back to work. A year's, you know, a break in a year is not a big deal. And I was thinking, great, mom. But, you know, a year turned to like 4 years and, you know, she was pretty happy with the way things were. So I think parents eventually, all they want is for us to be happy.
Yeah.
So, you know, they come around eventually. So I'm glad that it worked.
Yeah.
Now, you also have a column, right? You have a column.
I do.
Can you tell us a little bit about the column?
Yeah, so the column is called A Brown Kitchen, which is basically an extension of my blog. I'm really lucky that I have an editor who lets me do and write what I want. But the column is basically about what it means to be an immigrant today. And so I try to do that with food. So I share, often I share like a personal anecdote or a story behind the recipe. And then I tie that in somehow through food. And then it's also a way for me to kind of show people that what we think of something or we perceive as something isn't always what it is. So if people like I've mentioned before, like a lot of people think Indian food is naan and curries. And so I wanted to kind of get away from that. And I did that on my blog. And that's what the editors wanted me to do as well. Like, you know, do what you want to do. And I did that. And so it's been fun having this new platform to kind of write, because you're also reaching a different audience.
Correct.
And so it's been fun. So I get to like write about things that I could go back to the basics. So like when we first started out, I wrote a special thing on spices and Indian cooking. And then I did one on rice. And I wanted to stray away from basmati, even though I love basmati rice. But there are so many different varieties of rice used in Indian cooking. And you know that, like in Idli, you use a special kind of rice.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And so I kind of wanted to draw attention to those things and show people that there is a lot of diversity within Indian cooking. You know, like there's regional cooking, and then even within a region, there are so many variations.
Right.
And then how does that apply from an immigrant's perspective? Because I am not always cooking the norm. so to speak, at home. And so that's not what I'm going to share with you. There is the occasion that I will share something a little more like a dal or something on the column. But that's very rare. It's more about using those flavors, because at the end of the day, I'm passionate about what makes something different, as well as the pursuit of flavor. And so that's pretty much what the column is about.
No, it's beautifully written.
Oh, thank you.
It's, when you said you have free hand and you write more than you photograph, right? I mean, you share relevant things and you share things that really give a perspective into an immigrant and also an Indian immigrant and also food. So I have a niece who was studying in Berkeley.
Okay.
And I would tell her, can you please keep the Sunday newspaper? Because I'm old school. I like, physical books and papers. And I, even though I'm kind of, have a computer background, I'm like, I much rather like read a book and I much rather write. So I've had her send me a few clippings of.
Oh, that's so cool. Thank you.
Yeah. So I have those. I think one of the, like a mango one you did.
Oh yeah.
That's the one she.
Yeah. Somehow I go through a mango phase.
Yeah. Yeah. Now your last one, I have to bring this up because it was, like I said, beautifully written and you shared a lot of personal stuff in the last one that you did. And perhaps we can talk about that, especially in terms of the Section 377 ruling that just happened in India.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about, sort of your experience, and you also tied it very beautifully into figs. So could you expand a little bit on that?
Sure. As a child, I always knew I was different, right? And one of the reasons why I left India was because I knew I was gay and I knew it would not be accepted at that point there. And so there was always this fear inside of me that A, something was wrong with me because I didn't have anyone to talk to. I couldn't confide in my parents or anyone because I just did not feel confident or comfortable enough. Because also growing up in India, back then it wasn't talked about. You didn't see it on TV. And even when it was mentioned, even like Bollywood and the media portrays gay people as a section of society that you don't really interact with, but you make jokes of them constantly. And so it's looked down upon in every possible way. And then the other thing was I was also bullied heavily in school because, I mean, I'm pretty sure like a lot of the kids suspected. And so I just had a miserable time. And so India never felt safe. And so that's what one of the big motivating factors for me to leave India and come to America was because I was gay. And so I've moved here, and by this, the 377 happened like a couple of weeks ago. It was a very interesting experience for me because for the longest time now, I'm so accustomed to being out and I'm comfortable with my sexuality and I speak openly about it. I've never had to hide. And I've taken a lot of things for granted. So when the 377 ruling happened, it was like a emotional moment for me because I had to learn that and remember that a lot of the people that are in countries like India don't have the same rights or the freedoms that I do now. And I'm living my life freely now, but they don't. So for me, it was like I had like a flashback thinking about when I was in India growing up, like how I felt. And then, when you move here, you don't think about those things. And then I'm also trying to trying to put myself in someone else's shoes. That is the kid who might be gay, who is thinking about these things and wondering, do I fit in?
Right.
Right. Should I be born? Should I have been born? I mean, that was like a actual question that crossed my mind often, that do I fit here? Is this right? Is this wrong? You just don't know because you have no comparative skill. And I mean, of course, I was fortunate that I did not have any bad. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like terrible. They're bad, but they're not like some people lose their lives.
Right.
And I was fortunate to get away and my life worked out fine. But it's always been at the back of my mind. After I wrote that piece, I had a lot of gay Indians, both male and female, write to me and write to the newspaper and say that, that was a big reason for them too to escape. Because it's not easy. I mean, you have societal pressure too. But if you're coming from a much more, like a much more conservative family, then you have to get married. I didn't have that, so I was lucky. But then there's also like this pressure about how to behave in public. So you have to go and date a girl, or you have to take a girl to a prom, and you don't want to do that. And you just don't even want to go to the prom.
Right.
And so there were all these things that I feel that even with the ruling, I'm sure it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a while.
Right.
But it at least sets the precedent eventually for people to kind of phase it out, that this is okay. There's nothing wrong with being different.
I absolutely agree. And I think for a country to take that stance, especially a country like India, right? I mean, that's a huge step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you're right. Things are going to take a while to change. But the fact that, you know, they did it just shows that, okay, it's sort of getting a little progressive, and it's okay. It's okay to be who you are.
Yeah.
It's okay to live your life the way it's meant to be lived, as opposed to trying to be somebody you're not. I'm definitely going to link that article to the show notes because I thought it was brilliantly written. And you,
oh, thank you.
A poetic almost sort of reference to fig, because I think you said something like you compared it to like the fruit and the, you know, the tenderness and the sweetness. So it was just beautifully written. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, thank you.
A lot of people, like you said, I'm glad that it opened a lot of sort of people to talk about it, because we should. We need to kind of address these issues, and we need to bring it out in the open. So let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about the new baby in your life. So your book has just been published, and it's a phenomenal book, right? It's coming out on October 2nd.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your sort of, why did you want to do the book, and how does all your experiences, your things that you have kind of gone through in life, and, you know, your hopes and dreams, how has that sort of played out in your book?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Season, which comes out on October 2nd, that I wrote, styled, and photographed. And I was never ready to write a book because I didn't know what I wanted to write about. And I think that, for me, was the biggest challenge. Once I figured out what I wanted to tell people, it made sense then for me to write a book. Like I said before, I really didn't want to rehash any information that was already out there. People could go buy those books and they really didn't need to hear me yap about something that they had already had in their houses, probably. So when I wrote Season, I really wanted to talk, one, about my passion, which is flavor. So not only spices, but also the techniques that draw out flavor in food. So something as simple like caramelizing a butternut squash makes it taste different. Even an onion, right? It changes so much in complexity.
Right.
Or you add like a spice or an acid and how that changes. But I wanted to do that from a home cook's perspective, where people feel confident and comfortable in the kitchen. And then I also wanted the book, since it's my first book, to introduce myself to people and say, hey, this is who I am. I'm an immigrant. I came from India. I've lived in America. I've married someone from the South, and I'm also gay. And so these experiences have all shaped the way I think about food, the way I write, the way I cook,
right,
the way I season my food. And so season in itself, the word for the title for the book, is not only is it the verb to season food, but it's also metaphorical, where I'm referring to the seasons in my life that changed me.
Wonderful. I mean, that's definitely unique. When you think about seasons, you're like, okay, you're thinking about all these different changes, but to kind of take it in a metaphoric level and, you know, kind of look inward,
yeah,
and draw on your own experiences, that's beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
How, you know, you sort of draw very strongly from your cultural heritage, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you kind of are open and you encourage people to like break the rules and start your own traditions. Have you ever encountered any sort of resistance or pushback from, shall we call, like the purists? Or do you find most people kind of really appreciate and are on board with your take on recipes and food?
Now I do. Before, I didn't. So when I mean I didn't, before I used to have a lot of resistance, where I would get comments from people saying, this is not how my mom cooks it, or this is not the way it's done. And that's fine. There are so many nuances to everything in Indian cooking. And being traditional has never been my thing, because at the end of the day, I don't identify, or I actually don't even like the word traditional. I don't like the word authentic. And I try my best to refrain from using that when I write. Because there is, if you think about it, there's nothing as traditional, right? Or authentic. Because if I'm cooking a dish that my mom prepared, she's learned it from, say, for example, her mom. My grandmother then learned it from someone else, probably my great-grandmother or like her mother-in-law. And so there are all these people that, so it's like where you hear something and it changes a little bit every time.
Right.
And so I feel the story and the narrative keeps changing, and that's okay for it to change. I think people sometimes are so tied up into what this dream of tradition is, and they're trying to sell that. And I don't think that does justice to a culture, especially Indian food, because there's so much variety in Indian food. And if you're going to stifle yourself with holding on to things, how do you move on? How do you expand? How do you grow?
Right.
The only way to grow is to experiment and to bring new things in, keep your mind open. One of the things for me to do this was I watched my parents. So my parents, like I've mentioned before, came from different faiths, different backgrounds, different parts of the country. Their families were not for their marriage. And so that for me, I think, has been the biggest example in my life, watching how tradition stifled their families initially. And so I never wanted to do that to myself. And so with cooking, I feel it's the same thing. It plays out where there is this desire to hold on to a dream that doesn't exist. And sure, you need to know how to cook certain things, like because they've been perfected and they work well. But it's okay sometimes to just stray away a little bit. Why would you? I don't understand the idea of tying yourself up and forcing yourself to do something a certain way because out of guilt, maybe. I don't know. And so I was fortunate that never to have had that experience. And I do things my own way.
No, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, you're taking the stance that you want to put your own spin to something, right?
Right.
You are an individual. You've kind of had these experiences. You're in an environment or you're in a country where there's so much, you know, diversity and culture and everything anyway.
Right.
So why not just be open to those things? And, you know, if you want to have caramel in something that doesn't ask for it, why not? Try it, right? What's the best that can happen?
And I feel like for home cooks, it was a very interesting experience for me to see home cooks never getting that freedom, but chefs do. And this happens in India too.
That's interesting.
If you look at home cooks, for some reason, there's this expectation that you have to follow your grandma. It's like this exoticized fantasy of what it should be.
Right.
But then you look at chefs, even in India, they're playing with flavor. They're bringing Japanese food into Indian cooking. You know, those umami flavors now.
Right.
You can go to Indian restaurants and you'll see kheer being served with, say, a raspberry compote. But why can't a home cook do that in India? And so why is there this bias? And so I said, you know what? If people don't like it, it's a recipe. You can move on and cook something else. No, I'm not like holding it at gunpoint and saying you have to make this, right? You're an individual and you have the choice. It's your freedom to agree or disagree with me. It's also my freedom to do what I want.
You're giving people freedom to experiment through food, because that's right. What you do, and you know, you do it well. So why not?
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so do you miss home? I mean, I feel like we both live, you know, so many miles away from home and we've grown up there. Do you ever miss it?
So this is a very like deep question. Yes and no. Because I had such traumatic childhood being, you know, with the whole about being gay and everything in India, I do not miss it from that aspect. But I ended up becoming an adult in America. America is my home to me. And I can't separate like that. It sounds weird. And I might be sounding like disloyal to India in some way. But the truth of the matter is America made me feel safe. I didn't have that in India. So for me, I love going back to India when I'm, you know, when I go to visit my family, I'm on vacation. It's an amazing like experience for me, and I do enjoy that. The first few minutes, I think I wrote about this in that article, though. The first few minutes when I'm on the plane, it does stress me out because I start thinking about the past. And then once I'm there with my family and everything, it's better.
Yeah.
But the other thing is a lot of my family doesn't live in India anymore.
Okay.
And so I don't really have a lot of like cousins and stuff that live there. So my friends have also all moved away. And so things are different. So I feel like now when I go, it is a second home. But I'm also in many ways a tourist, so to speak, because I'm also looking at it now with a different lens. I'm trying to understand India and see what it, you know, like the, appreciate the culture, things that I never paid attention to when I lived there. You know, looking at different things. And so I appreciate it more now as an adult. Because I'm more conscious about things and a little more mature, hopefully. But in that sense, I also never went back to India. I went to India after I moved to America after 2 years. In the first 2 years, I went once. And after that, I never went. And I went back to India for the first time 4 years ago. And then again last December. So I've also not gone continuously to see family. And then my family kept visiting. So it, in that sense, it's very different for me.
And that's totally fine. I don't think that just because you don't miss it, it's not a part of your life. I think you kind of, the way I see it, you bring about your culture and, you know, where you are from in a different way. And that's through food and your work. And you even like, you know, like you said, the brown table, the brown kitchen, you're sort of paying homage to where you are in that sense. So I think, you know, it's still there. And that's fine in whatever level it is. Like, I don't have much family back home from my side, from my husband's side, But, and like you said, like when you go back, you start looking at things from a different sort of lens, you know, things like you didn't pay attention to before when you were growing up. You sort of all of a sudden, it's like your senses are heightened and, you know, you kind of, like you said earlier, the guy who rolls the vegetables in the cart, it still happens today in India. And it's fascinating because it's such an interesting experience to interact. You know, it's not like you just go to a supermarket and you pick up something from a shelf, you walk away, you have no interaction. So much of interaction in that just simple process of buying fruits and vegetables. So it's that's definitely an experience. So do you have any comfort food that you find that you sort of gravitate towards or, you know, that you cook for your husband or anything that's sort of your go-to that you like above everything else?
Let's see. I do like rice a lot. Surprisingly enough, dosa is my thing. Because my mom could never like roll out the batter and everything. And once I learned how to do it and she couldn't do it, I was like, oh, I can do it. You can't do it. But so I'm really proud of that. And I've, like when she comes, so I make her dosa now, which is kind of funny. But I love making dosa. And so dosa has become like my go-to comfort food. I'm not even South Indian, so it's kind of funny. But I make dosa once a month for my husband and me, and we both love it.
That's dosa is sort of a universal, has universal appeal. So my Anuj's like my husband is also from the, we kind of come from two different backgrounds. So he's from the north and I'm from the south.
He loves
South Indian food. And I'm like, it's the same thing. I mean, it's nothing special. And he's like, can you please make some idli and dosa? I'm like, oh, can I make something else? And he's like, no. All right. This has been amazing, Nick. Perhaps a couple of questions to sort of, you know, wrap this up. You said at one point your sort of goal was to go to culinary school. Is that something that's still on the cards?
I don't think so now. I feel I'm actually more interested in maybe traveling and experiencing the world more and learning about people and the food that they cook. Especially stuff that no one writes about. And so I've become really kind of fascinated from a scientific as well as a cultural, like historical perspective to understand what's going on. And that's something that I think I would like to pursue as time goes on.
Wonderful. That's definitely a lot of learnings there. So what lies ahead for you? What's next? Are you sort of fully living your dream or do you have any, apart from the travel?
As of now, I'm just waiting for the book to come out and I hope people like it and appreciate the book. And that's kind of my focus right now for the next couple of months. And then we'll see where things go in the new year.
No, it's gotten a lot of publicity and a lot of good publicity. I know you share a ton on your Instagram and it's just, I can't wait to get my hands on on the book.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Just the pictures, and I think just the way you write and the way you storytell is very unique and very fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here and for sharing all this stuff. And I wish you the very best. And, you know, thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Culturally Ours. Check out the show notes at culturallyours.com. If you've enjoyed the show, please be sure to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and share it with your family and friends.